his consciousness of his own weakness, the ineffectual effort that he made against it, the struggle between his shame in Uriah's deportment and his desire to conciliate him, the manifest exultation with which Uriah twisted and turned and held him up before me. It made me sick at heart to see, and my hand recoils from writing it. "Come, fellow partner," said Uriah at last, "I'll give you another one, and I humbly ask for bumpers, seeing I intend to make it the divinest of her sex." Her father had his empty glass in his hand. I saw him set it down, look at the picture she was so like, put his hand to his forehead, and shrink back in his elbow chair. "I'm a humble individual to give you her health," proceeded Uriah, "but I admire, adore her." No physical pain that her father's grey head could have borne, I think, could have been more terrible to me than the mental endurance I saw compressed now within both his hands. "Agnes," said Uriah, either not regarding him or not knowing what the nature of his action was. "Agnes Wickfield is, I am safe to say, the divinest of her sex. May I speak out among friends? To be her father is a proud distinction, but to be her husband..." Spare me from ever again hearing such a cry as that with which her father rose up from the table. "What's the matter?" said Uriah, turning of a deadly colour. "You're not gone mad after all, Mr. Wickfield, I hope?" "If I say I've an ambition to make your Agnes my Agnes, I have as good a right to it as another man. I have a better right to it than any other man." I had my arms round Mr. Wickfield, imploring him by everything that I could think of, oftenest of all by his love for Agnes, to calm himself a little. He was mad for the moment, tearing out his hair, beating his head, trying to force me from him, and to force himself from me, not answering a word, not looking at or seeing anyone, blindly striving for he knew not what, his face all staring and distorted, a frightful spectacle. I conjured him incoherently, but in the most impassioned manner, not to abandon himself to this wildness, but to hear me. I besought him to think of Agnes, to connect me with Agnes, to recollect how Agnes and I had grown up together, how I honoured her and loved her, how she was his pride and joy. I tried to bring her idea before him in any form. I even reproached him with not having firmness to spare her the knowledge of such a scene as this. I may have effected something, or his wildness may have spent itself, but by degrees he struggled less and began to look at me. Strangely at first, then with recognition in his eyes. At length he said, "I know, Trotwood. My darling child and you, I know. But look at him." He pointed to Uriah, pale and glowering in a corner, evidently very much out in his calculations and taken by surprise. "Look at my torturer," he replied. "Before him I have step by step abandoned name and reputation, peace and quiet, house and home." "I have kept your name and reputation for you, and your peace and quiet, and your house and home too," said Uriah, with a sulky, hurried, defeated air of compromise. "Don't be foolish, Mr. Wickfield. If I've got a little beyond what you were prepared for, I can go back, I suppose. There's no harm done." "I looked for single motives in every one," said Mr. Wickfield, "and I was satisfied I had bound him to me by motives of interest. But see what he is! Oh, see what he is!" "You'd better stop him, Copperfield, if you can," cried Uriah, with his long forefinger pointing towards me. "He'll say something presently, mind you. He'll be sorry to have said afterwards, and you'll be sorry to have heard." "I'll say anything," cried Mr. Wickfield with a desperate air. "Why should I not be in all the world's power if I am in yours? Mind, I tell you," said Uriah, continuing to warn me, "if you don't stop his mouth, you're not his friend. Why shouldn't you be in all the world's power, Mr. Wickfield? Because you've got a daughter. You and me know what we know, don't we? Let sleeping dogs lie. Who wants to rouse them? I don't. Can't you see I'm as humble as I can be? I tell you, if I've gone too far, I'm sorry. What would you have, sir? Oh, Trotwood, Trotwood! Exclaimed Mr. Wickfield, wringing his hands. What I have come down to be since I first saw you in this house! I was on my downward way then, but the dreary, dreary road I have traversed since. Weak indulgence has ruined me. Indulgence in remembrance and indulgence in forgetfulness. My natural grief for my child's mother turned to disease. My natural love for my child turned to disease. I have infected everything I touched. I have brought misery on what I dearly love. I know. You know. I thought it possible that I could truly love one creature in the world and not love the rest. I thought it possible that I could truly mourn for one creature gone out of the world and not have some part in the grief of all who mourned. Thus, the lessons of my life have been perverted. I've preyed on my own morbid coward heart, and it has preyed on me. Sordid in my grief, sordid in my love, sordid in my miserable escape from the darker side of both. Oh, see the ruin I am, and hate me, shun me. He dropped into a chair and weakly sobbed. The excitement into which he had been roused was leaving him. Uriah came out of his corner. I don't know all I have done in my fatuity, said Mr. Wickfield, putting out his hands as if to deprecate my condemnation. He knows best, meaning Uriah Heep, for he has always been at my elbow whispering me. You see the millstone that he is about my neck. You find him in my house, you find him in my business. You heard him but a little time ago. What need have I to say more? You haven't need to say so much, nor half so much, nor anything at all, observed Uriah, half defiant and half fawning. You wouldn't have took it up so if it hadn't been for the wine. You'll think better of it tomorrow, sir. If I said too much or more than I meant, what of it? I haven't stood by it. The door opened, and Agnes, gliding in, without a vestige of colour in her face, put her arm round his neck and steadily said, Papa, you're not well. Come with me. He laid his head upon her shoulder, as if he were oppressed with heavy shame, and went out with her. Her eyes met mine for but an instant. Yet I saw how much she knew of what had passed. "I didn't expect it cut up so rough, Master Copperfield," said Uriah. "But it's nothing. I'll be friends with him tomorrow. It's for his good. I'm humbly anxious for his good." I gave him no answer and went upstairs into the quiet room where Agnes had so often sat beside me at my books. Nobody came near me until late at night. I took up a book and tried to read. I heard the clocks strike 12, and was still reading without knowing what I read, when Agnes touched me. "You'll be going early in the morning, Trotwood. Let us say goodbye now." She'd been weeping, but her face then was so calm and beautiful. "Heaven bless you," she said, giving me her hand. "Dearest Agnes," I returned, "I see you ask me not to speak of tonight. But is there nothing to be done?" "There is God to trust in," she replied. "Can I do nothing? I who come to you with my poor sorrows, and make mine so much lighter she replied, "dear Trotwood, no. Agnes." "Dear Agnes," I said, "it is presumptuous for me, who am so poor in all in which you are so rich, goodness, resolution, all noble qualities, to doubt or direct you, but you know how much I love you and how much I owe you. You will never sacrifice yourself to a mistaken sense of duty, Agnes." More agitated for a moment than I had ever seen her, she took a hand from me and moved a step back. "Say you have no such thought, dear Agnes. Much more than sister. Think of the priceless gift of such a heart as yours, of such a love as yours." Oh, long, long afterwards, I saw that face rise up before me, with its momentary look not wondering, not accusing, not regretting. Oh, long, long afterwards, I saw that look subside, as it did now, into the lovely smile with which she told me she had no fear for herself. I need have none for her, and parted from me by the name of brother, and was gone. It was dark in the morning when I got upon the coach at the inn door. The day was just breaking when we were about to start, and then, as I sat thinking of her, came struggling up the coach side through the mingled day and night Uriah's head. "Got the field," said he, in a croaking whisper as he hung on by the iron on the roof. "I thought you'd be glad to hear before you went off that there are no squares broke between us. I've been into his room already, and we've made it all smooth. Why, though I'm humble, I'm useful to him, you know. And he understands his interest when he isn't in liquor. What an agreeable man he is, after all, Master Copperfield." I obliged myself to say that I was glad he had made his apology. "Oh, to be sure," said Uriah. "When a person's humble, you know, what's an apology? So easy, I say. I suppose," with a jerk, "you have sometimes plucked a pear before it was ripe, Master Copperfield?" "I suppose I have," I replied. "I did that last night," said Uriah. "But it'll ripen yet. It only wants attending to. I can wait." Profuse in his farewells, he got down again as the coachman got up. For anything I know, he was eating something to keep the raw morning air out, but he made motions with his mouth, as if the pear were ripe already, and he were smacking his lips over it. Chapter 40. The Wanderer. We had a very serious conversation in Buckingham Street that night about the domestic occurrences I've detailed in the last chapter. My aunt was deeply interested in them, and walked up and down the room with her arms folded for more than 2 hours afterwards. Whenever she was particularly discomposed, she always performed one of these pedestrian feats, and the amount of her discomposure might always be estimated by the duration of her walk. On this occasion, she was so much disturbed in mind as to find it necessary to open the bedroom door and make a course for herself, comprising the full extent of the two rooms from wall to wall. And while Mr. Dick and I sat quietly by the fire, she kept passing in and out along this measured track at an unchanging pace with the regularity of a clock pendulum. When my aunt and I were left to ourselves by Mr. Dick's going out to bed, I sat down to write my letter to the two old ladies. By that time she was tired of walking and sat by the fire with her dress tucked up as usual. But instead of sitting in her usual manner, holding her glass upon her knee, she suffered it to stand neglected on the chimney-piece, and resting her left elbow on her right arm and her chin on her left hand, looked thoughtfully at me. As often as I raised my eyes from what I was about, I met hers. "I'm in the lovingest of tempers, my dear," she would assure me with a nod, "but I'm fidgeted and sorry." I'd been too busy to observe until after she was gone to bed that she had left her night mixture, as she always called it, untasted on the chimney-piece. She came to her door with even more than her usual affection of manner when I knocked to acquaint her with this discovery, but only said, "I have not the heart to take it, Trot, tonight," and shook her head and went in again. She read my letter to the two old ladies in the morning and approved of it. I posted it, and had nothing to do then but wait as patiently as I could for the reply. I was still in this state of expectation, and had been for nearly a week, when I left the doctor's one snowy night to walk home. It had been a bitter day, and a cutting northeast wind had blown for some time. The wind had gone down with the light, and so the snow had come on. It was a heavy settled fall, I recollect, in great flakes. And it lay thick. The noise of wheels and tread of people were as hushed as if the streets had been strewn that depth with feathers. My shortest way home, and I naturally took the shortest way on such a night, was through St. Martin's Lane. Now, the church, which gives its name to the lane, stood in a less free situation at that time, there being no open space before it, and the lane winding down to the Strand. As I passed the steps of the portico, I encountered at the corner a woman's face. It looked in mine, passed across the narrow lane, and disappeared. I knew it. I'd seen it somewhere, but I couldn't remember where. I had some association with it that struck upon my heart directly. But I was thinking of anything else when it came upon me and was confused. On the steps of the church there was the stooping figure of a man who had put down some burden on the smooth snow to adjust it. My seeing the face and my seeing him were simultaneous. I don't think I'd stopped in my surprise, but in any case, as I went on, he rose, turned, and came down towards me. I stood face to face with Mr. Peggotty. Then I remembered the woman. It was Martha, to whom Emily had given the money that night in the kitchen. Martha Endell, side by side with whom he wouldn't have seen his dear niece, Hammond told me, for all the treasures wrecked in the sea. We shook hands heartily. At first, neither of us could speak a word. "Master Davy," he said, gripping me tight, "it do my heart good to see you, sir. Well met, well met." "Well met, my dear old friend," said I. "I had my thoughts of coming to make inquiration for you, sir, tonight," he said, "but knowing as your aunt was living along with you, for I've been down yonder Yarmouth way, I was afeard it was too late. I should have come early in the morning, sir, afore going away." "Again?" said I. "Yes, sir," he replied, patiently shaking his head. "I'm away tomorrow." "Where were you going now?" I asked. "Well," he replied, shaking the snow out of his long hair, "I was going to turn in somewheres." In those days there was a side entrance to the stable yard of the Golden Cross, the inn so memorable to me in connection with his misfortune, nearly opposite to where we stood. I pointed out the gateway, put my arm through his, and we went across. Two or three public rooms opened out of the stable yard, and looking into one of them and finding it empty and a good fire burning, I took him in there. When I saw him in the light, I observed not only that his hair was long and ragged, but that his face was burnt dark by the sun. He was greyer, the lines in his face and forehead were deeper, and he had every appearance of having toiled and wandered through all varieties of weather. But he looked very strong, and like a man upheld by steadfastness of purpose whom nothing could tire out. He shook the snow from his hat and clothes and brushed it away from his face while I was inwardly making these remarks. As he sat down opposite to me at a table with his back to the door by which we'd entered, he put out his rough hand again and grasped mine warmly. "I'll tell you, Master Davy," he said, where all I've been and what all we've heard. I've been fair, and we've heard little, but I'll tell you. I rang the bell for something hot to drink. He would have nothing stronger than ale, and while it was being brought and being warmed at the fire, he sat thinking. There was a fine, massive gravity in his face I didn't venture to disturb. When she was a child, he said, lifting up his head soon after we were left alone, she used to talk to me a deal about the sea and about them coasts where the sea got to be dark and blue and to lay a-shining and a-shining in the sun. I thought odd times as her father being drowned would make her think on it so much. I don't know now, you see, but maybe she believed, or hoped, he had drifted out to them parts where the flowers is always a-blowing and the country bright. It is likely to have been a childish fancy, I replied. When she was lost, said Mr. Peggotty, I knowed in my mind as he would take her to them countries. I knowed in my mind as he'd have told her wonders of them, and how she was to be a lady there, and how he got her to listen to him fust along and such like. When we see his mother, I knowed quite well as I was right. I went across channel to France and landed there as if I fell down from the sky. I saw the door move and the snow drift in. I saw it move a little more and a hand softly interposed to keep it open. I found out an English gentleman as was in authority, said Mr. Peggotty, and told him I was going to seek my niece. He got me them papers as I wanted for to carry me through. I don't rightly know how they're called, and he would have given me money, but that I was thankful to have no need on. I thank him kind for all he'd done, I'm sure. I wrote afore you, he says to me, and I shall speak to many as will come that way, and many will know you fur distant from here when you're a-travelling alone. I told him best as I was able what my gratitude was, and went away through France. Alone and on foot, said I. Mostly afoot, he rejoined. Sometimes in carts, along with people going to market, sometimes in empty coaches. Many mile a day afoot, and often with some poor soldier or another travelling to see his friends. I couldn't talk to him, said Mr. Peggotty, nor he to me, but we was company for one another too along the dusty roads. I should have known that by his friendly tone. When I come to any town, he pursued, I found the inn and waited about the yard till someone turned up, someone mostly did, as knowed English. Then I told how that I was on my way to seek my niece, and they told me what manner of gentlefolks was in the house, and I waited to see any as seemed like her going in or out. When it weren't Emily, I went on again. By little and little, when I come to a new village or that among the poor people, I found they knowed about me. They would set me down at their cottage doors and give me what not for to eat and drink and show me where to sleep. And many a woman, Master Davy, has had a daughter of about Emily's age I found a-waiting for me at Our Saviour's Cross outside the village for to do me similar kindnesses. Some has had daughters as was dead, and God only knows how good them mothers was to me. It was Martha at the door. I saw her haggard, listening face distinctly. My dread was lest he should turn his head and see her too. They would often put their children, particularly their little girls, said Mr. Peggotty, upon my knee. And many a time you might see me sitting at their doors when night was coming on, almost as if they'd been my darling's children. Oh, my darling. Overpowered by sudden grief, he sobbed aloud. I laid my trembling hand upon the hand he put before his face. "Thank you, sir," he said. "Don't take no notice." In a very little while he took his hand away and put it in his breast and went on with his story. "They often walk with me," he said, "in the morning, maybe a mile or two upon my road. And when we parted and I said, 'I'm very thankful to you, God bless you,' they always seemed to understand and answered pleasant. At last I come to the sea. It weren't hard, you may suppose, for a seafaring man like me to work his way over to Italy. When I got there, I wandered on as I'd done afore. The people was just as good to me, and I should have gone from town to town, maybe the country through, but that I got news of her being seen among them Swiss mountains yonder. One as knowed his sarvants see him there all three, and told me how they travelled and where they was. I made for them mountains, Master Davy, day and night. Ever so fur as I went, ever so fur, the mountains seemed to shift away from me, but I come up with them and I crossed them. When I got nigh the places I'd been told on, I began to think within my own self, 'What shall I do when I see her?'" The listening face, insensible to the inclement night, still drooped at the door, and the hands begged me, prayed me not to cast it forth. "I never doubted her," said Mr. Peggotty. "No, not a bit. Only let her see my face. Only let her hear my voice. Only let my standing still afore her bring to her thoughts the home she'd fled away from, and the child she had been. And if she'd growed to be a royal lady, she'd have fell down at my feet. I knowed it well. Many a time in my sleep when I heard her cry out, 'Uncle,' and seen her fall like death afore me. Many a time in my sleep when I raised her up and whispered to her, 'Emily, my dear, I am come for to bring forgiveness and to take you home.'" He stopped and shook his head, and went on with a sigh. "He was nowt to me now. Emily was all. I bought a country dress to put upon her, and I knew that once found she would walk beside me over them stony roads, go where I would, and never, never leave me more. To put that dress upon her, and to cast off what she wore, to take her on my arm again and wander towards home, to stop sometimes upon the road and heal her bruised feet and her worst bruised heart, was all I thought of now. I don't believe I should have done so much as look at him. But, Master Davy, it warn't to be. Not yet. I was too late, and they was gone. Where, I couldn't learn. Some said here, some said there. I travelled here, and I travelled there, but I found no Emily. And I travelled home." "How long ago?" I asked. "A matter of 4 days," said Mr. Peggotty. "I sighted the old boat out of the dark, and the light shining in the winder. When I come nigh and looked in through the glass, I see the faithful creature, Mrs. Gummidge, sitting by the fire, as we had fixed upon alone. I called out, 'Don't be afeard, it's Dan'l,' and I went in. I never could have thought the old boat would have been so strange." From some pocket in his breast he took out, with a very careful hand, a small paper bundle containing 2 or 3 letters or little packets, which he laid upon the table. "This first one come," he said, selecting it from the rest, "afore I'd been gone a week. A £50 banknote in a sheet of paper directed to me and put underneath the door in the night. She tried to hide her writing, but she couldn't hide it from me." He folded up the note again with great patience and care in exactly the same form and laid it on one side. "This come to Mrs. Gummidge," he said, opening another, 2 or 3 months ago. After looking at it for some moments, he gave it to me, and added in a low voice, "Be so good as read it, sir." I read as follows. Oh, what will you feel when you see this writing? I know it comes from my wicked hand, but try, try, not for my sake, but for Uncle's goodness, try to let your heart soften to me only for a little time. Pray, pray, relent towards a miserable girl, and write down on a bit of paper whether he is well and what he said about me before you left off ever naming me among yourselves, and whether of a night, when it is my old time of coming home, you ever see him look as if he thought of one he used to love so dear. Oh, my heart is breaking when I think about it. I'm kneeling down to you, begging and praying you not to be as hard with me as I deserve, as I well know I deserve, but to be so gentle and so good as to write down something of him and to send it to me. You need not call me little. You need not call me by the name I've disgraced. But, oh, listen to my agony, and have mercy on me so far as to write me some word of Uncle, never, never to be seen in this world by my eyes again. Dear, if your heart is hard towards me, justly hard, I know, but listen, if it is hard, dear, ask him I have wronged the most, him whose wife I was to have been, before you quite decide against my poor, poor prayer. If he should be so compassionate as to say that you might write something for me to read, I think he would, oh, I think he would, if you would only ask him, for he always was so brave and so forgiving. Tell him then, but not else, that now, when I hear the wind blowing at night, I feel as if it was passing angrily from seeing him and Uncle, and was going up to God against me. Tell him that if I was to die tomorrow, and oh, if I was fit, I would be so glad to die, I would bless him and Uncle with my last words, and pray for his happy home with my last breath. Some money was enclosed in this letter also. £5. It was untouched like the previous sum, and he refolded it in the same way. Detailed instructions were added relative to the address of a reply, which, although they betrayed the intervention of several hands and made it difficult to arrive at any very probable conclusion in reference to her place of concealment, made it at least not unlikely that she'd written from that spot where she was stated to have been seen. What answer was sent? I inquired of Mr. Peggotty. Mrs. Gummidge, he returned, not being a good scholar, sir, Ham kindly drawed it out, and she made a copy on it. They told her I was gone to seek her, and what my parting words was. Is that another letter in your hand? Said I. It's money, sir, said Mr. Peggotty, unfolding it a little way. £10, you see. And wrote inside, from a true friend, like the first. But the first was put underneath the door, and this come by the post day before yesterday. I'm going to seek her at the postmark. He showed it to me. It was a town on the Upper Rhine. He'd found out at Yarmouth some foreign dealers who knew that country, and they'd drawn him a rude map on paper, which he could very well understand. He laid it between us on the table, and with his chin resting on one hand, tracked his course upon it with the other. I asked him how Ham was. He shook his head. He works, he said, as bold as a man can. His name's as good in all that part as any man's is anywheres in the world. Everyone's hand is ready to help him, you understand, and his is ready to help them. He's never been heard for to complain. But my sister's belief is, 'twixt ourselves, as it has cut him deep. Poor fellow, I can believe it. "He ain't no care, Master Davy," said Mr. Peggotty in a solemn whisper. "Kinder no care nohow for his life." Well, a man's wanted for rough service and rough weather, he's there. When there's any hard duty to be done with danger in it, he steps forward for all his mates. And yet, he's as gentle as a child. There ain't a child in Yarmouth that don't know him. He gathered up the letters thoughtfully, smoothing them with his hand, put them into their little bundle, and placed it tenderly in his breast again. The face was gone from the door. I still saw the snow drifting in, but nothing else was there. "Well," he said, looking to his bag, "having seen you tonight, Master Davy, and that does me good, I shall away betimes tomorrow morning. You've seen what I've got here," putting his hand on where the little packet lay. "All that troubles me is the thought that any harm might come to me afore that money was give back. If I was to die and it was lost, or stole, or elseways made away with, and it was never knowed by him but what I'd took it, I believe the t'other world wouldn't hold me. I believe I must come back." He rose, and I rose too. We grasped each other by the hand again before going out. "I'd go 10,000 mile, he said. "I'd go till I drop dead to lay that money down afore him. If I do that and find my Emily, I'm content. If I don't find her, maybe she'll come to here sometime, as her loving uncle only ended his search for her when he ended his life. And if I know her, even that will turn her home at last." As we went out into the rigorous night, I saw the lonely figure flit away before us. I turned him hastily on some pretence and held him in conversation until it was gone. He spoke of a traveller's house on the Dover Road, where he knew he could find a clean, plain lodging for the night. I went with him over Westminster Bridge and parted from him on the Surrey shore. Everything seemed, to my imagination, to be hushed in reverence for him as he resumed his solitary journey through the snow. I returned to the inn yard, and, impressed by my remembrance of the face, looked awfully around for it. It was not there. The snow had covered our late footprints. My new track was the only one to be seen, and even that began to die away, it snowed so fast, as I looked back over my shoulder. Chapter 41. Dora's Aunts. At last an answer came from the two old ladies. They presented their compliments to Mr. Copperfield, and informed him that they had given his letter their best consideration, with a view to the happiness of both parties, which I thought rather an alarming expression, not only because of the use they'd made of it in relation to the family difference before mentioned, but because I had, and have all my life, observed that conventional phrases are a sort of fireworks easily let off, and liable to take a great variety of shapes and colours not at all suggested by their original form. The Mrs. Spenlow added that they begged to forbear expressing, through the medium of correspondence, an opinion on the subject of Mr. Copperfield's communication, but that if Mr. Copperfield would do them the favour to call upon a certain day, accompanied, if he thought proper, by a confidential friend, they would be happy to hold some conversation on the subject. To this favour Mr. Copperfield immediately replied, with his respectful compliments, that he would have the honour of waiting on the Mrs. Spenlow at the time appointed, accompanied, in accordance with their kind permission, by his friend Mr. Thomas Traddles of the Inner Temple. Having dispatched which missive, Mr. Copperfield fell into a condition of strong nervous agitation, and so remained until the day arrived. It was a great augmentation of my uneasiness to be bereaved at this eventful crisis of the inestimable services of Miss Mills. But Mr. Mills, who was always doing something or other to annoy me, or I felt as if he were, which was the same thing, had brought his conduct to a climax by taking it into his head that he would go to India. Why should he go to India except to harass me? To be sure, he had nothing to do with any other part of the world, and had a good deal to do with that part, being entirely in the India trade, whatever that was. I had floating dreams myself concerning golden shawls and elephant's teeth. Having been at Calcutta in his youth, and designing now to go out there again in the capacity of resident partner. But this was nothing to me. However, it was so much to him that for India he was bound, and Julia with him. And Julia went into the country to take leave of her relations, and the house was put into a perfect suit of bills, announcing that it was to be let or sold, and that the furniture, mangle and all, was to be taken at a valuation. So here was another earthquake, of which I became the sport before I'd recovered from the shock of its predecessor. I was in several minds how to dress myself on the important day, being divided between my desire to appear to advantage and my apprehensions of putting on anything that might impair my severely practical character in the eyes of the Mrs. Spenlow. I endeavoured to hit a happy medium between these two extremes. My aunt approved the result, and Mr. Dick threw one of his shoes after Traddles and me for luck as we went downstairs. Excellent fellow as I knew Traddles to be, and warmly attached to him as I was, I couldn't help wishing, on that delicate occasion, that he had never contracted the habit of brushing his hair so very upright. It gave him a surprised look, not to say a half-broomy kind of expression, which, my apprehensions whispered, might be fatal to us. I took the liberty of mentioning it to Traddles, as we were walking to Putney, and saying that if he would smooth it down a little. "My dear Copperfield," said Traddles, lifting off his hat and rubbing his hair all kinds of ways, "nothing would give me greater pleasure, but it won't." "Won't be smoothed down," said I. "No," said Traddles, "nothing will induce it. If I was to carry a half hundred weight upon it all the way to Putney, it would be up again the moment the weight was taken off. You've no idea what obstinate hair mine is, Copperfield. I'm quite a fretful porcupine." I was a little disappointed, I must confess, but thoroughly charmed by his good nature, too. I told him how I esteemed his good nature, and said that his hair must have taken all the obstinacy out of his character, for he had none. "Oh," returned Traddles, laughing, "I assure you it's quite an old story, my unfortunate hair. My uncle's wife couldn't bear it. She said it exasperated her. It stood very much in my way, too, when I first fell in love with Sophie, very much." "Did she object to it?" "She didn't," rejoined Traddles. "But her eldest sister, the one that's the beauty, quite made game of it, I understand. In fact, all the sisters laugh at it." "Agreeable," said I. "Yes," returned Traddles, with perfect innocence. "It's a joke for us. They pretend that Sophie has a lock of it in her desk and is obliged to shut it in a clasped book to keep it down. We laugh about it." "By the by, my dear Traddles," said I, "your experience may suggest something to me. When you became engaged to the young lady whom you've just mentioned, did you make a regular proposal to her family? Was there anything like what we're going through today, for instance?" I added nervously. "Why," replied Traddles, on whose attentive face a thoughtful shade had stolen, "it was rather a painful transaction, Copperfield, in my case. You see, Sophie being of so much use in the family, none of them could endure the thought of her ever being married. Indeed, they'd quite settled among themselves that she never was to be married, and they called her the old maid. Accordingly, when I mentioned it, with the greatest precaution, to Mrs. Crewler..." "The mamma," said I. "The mamma," said Traddles. "Reverend Horace Crewler. When I mentioned it, with every possible precaution, to Mrs. Crewler, the effect upon her was such that she gave a scream and became insensible. I couldn't approach the subject again for months." "You did at last," said I. "Well, the Reverend Horace did," said Traddles. "He's an excellent man, most exemplary in every way, and he pointed out to her that she ought, as a Christian, to reconcile herself to the sacrifice, especially as it was so uncertain, and to bear no uncharitable feeling towards me. As to myself, Copperfield, I give you my word I felt a perfect bird of prey towards the family.
This ends side one of cassette 19. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
The sisters took your part, I hope, Traddles. Why, I can't say they did, he returned. When we had comparatively reconciled Mrs. Crewler to it, we had to break it to Sarah. You recollect my mentioning Sarah as the one that has something the matter with her spine? Perfectly. She clenched both her hands, said Traddles, looking at me in dismay, shut her eyes, turned lead colour, became perfectly stiff, and took nothing for 2 days but toast and water administered with a teaspoon. What a very unpleasant girl, Traddles, I remarked. Oh, I beg your pardon, Copperfield, said Traddles. She is a very charming girl, but she has a great deal of feeling. In fact, they all have. Sophie told me afterwards that the self-reproach she underwent while she was in attendance upon Sarah no words could describe. I know it must have been severe by my own feelings, Copperfield, which were like a criminal's. After Sarah was restored, we still had to break it to the other eight, and it produced various effects upon them of a most pathetic nature. The two little ones, whom Sophie educates, have only just left off detesting me. At any rate, they're all reconciled to it now, I hope, said I. Yes, I should say they were, on the whole, resigned to it, said Traddles doubtfully. The fact is, we avoid mentioning the subject, and my unsettled prospects and indifferent circumstances are a great consolation to them. There'll be a deplorable scene whenever we are married. It'll be much more like a funeral than a wedding, and they'll all hate me for taking her away. His honest face, as he looked at me with a serio-comic shake of his head, impresses me more in the remembrance than it did in the reality. For I was by this time in a state of such excessive trepidation and wandering of mind as to be quite unable to fix my attention on anything. On our approaching the house where the Mrs. Spenlow lived, I was at such a discount in respect of my personal looks and presence of mind that Traddles proposed a gentle stimulant in the form of a glass of ale. This having been administered at a neighbouring public house, he conducted me, with tottering steps, to the Mrs. Spenlow's door. I had a vague sensation of being, as it were, on view when the maid opened it, and of wavering somehow across a hall with a weather glass in it, into a quiet little drawing-room on the ground floor commanding a neat garden. Also of sitting down here, on a sofa, and seeing Traddles's hair start up, now his hat was removed, like one of those obtrusive little figures made of springs that fly out of fictitious snuff-boxes when the lid is taken off. Also of hearing an old-fashioned clock ticking away on the chimney-piece, and trying to make it keep time to the jerking of my heart, which it wouldn't. Also of looking round the room for any sign of Dora and seeing none. Also of thinking that Jip once barked in the distance and was instantly choked by somebody. Ultimately, I found myself backing Traddles into the fireplace and bowing in great confusion to two dry little elderly ladies dressed in black, and each looking wonderfully like a preparation in chip or tan of the late Mr. Spenlow. "Pray," said one of the two little ladies, "be seated." When I'd done tumbling over Traddles and had sat upon something which was not a cat, my first seat was, I so far recovered my sight as to perceive that Mr. Spenlow had evidently been the youngest of the family, that there was a disparity of 6 or 8 years between the two sisters, and that the younger appeared to be the manager of the conference, inasmuch as she had my letter in her hand, so familiar as it looked to me and yet so odd, and was referring to it through an eyeglass. They were dressed alike, but this sister wore her dress with a more youthful air than the other, and perhaps had a trifle more frill or tucker or brooch or bracelet or some little thing of that kind, which made her look more lively. They were both upright in their carriage, formal, precise, composed, and quiet. The sister who had not my letter had her arms crossed on her breast and resting on each other like an idol. "Mr. Copperfield, I believe," said the sister who got my letter, addressing herself to Traddles. This was a frightful beginning. Traddles had to indicate that I was Mr. Copperfield, and I had to lay claim to myself, and they had to divest themselves of a preconceived opinion that Traddles was Mr. Copperfield, and altogether we were in a nice condition. To improve it, we all distinctly heard Jip give two short barks and receive another choke. "Mr. Copperfield," said the sister with the letter. I did something, bowed, I suppose, and was all attention when the other sister struck in. "My sister Lavinia," said she, "being conversant with matters of this nature, will state what we consider most calculated to promote the happiness of both parties." I discovered afterwards that Miss Lavinia was an authority in affairs of the heart, by reason of there having anciently existed a certain Mr. Pidger, who played short whist and was supposed to have been enamoured of her. My private opinion is that this was entirely a gratuitous assumption, and that Pidger was altogether innocent of any such sentiments, to which he had never given any sort of expression that I could ever hear of. Both Miss Lavinia and Miss Clarissa had a superstition, however, that he would have declared his passion if he had not been cut short in his youth, at about 60, by over-drinking his constitution and overdoing an attempt to set it right again by swilling bath water. They had a lurking suspicion, even, that he died of secret love. Though I must say there was a picture of him in the house with a damask nose, which concealment did not appear to have ever preyed upon. "We will not," said Miss Lavinia, "enter on the past history of this matter. Our poor brother Francis's death has cancelled that." "We had not," said Miss Clarissa, "been in the habit of frequent association with our brother Francis, but there was no decided division or disunion between us. Francis took his road, we took ours. We considered it conducive to the happiness of all parties that it should be so, and it was so." Each of the sisters leant a little forward to speak, shook her head after speaking, and became upright again when silent. Miss Clarissa never moved her arms. She sometimes played tunes upon them with her fingers, minuets and marches, I should think, but never moved them. "Our niece's position, or supposed position, is much changed by our brother Francis's death," said Miss Lavinia, "and therefore we consider our brother's opinions as regarded her position as being changed too. We have no reason to doubt, Mr. Copperfield, that you are a young gentleman possessed of good qualities and honourable character, or that you have an affection, or are fully persuaded that you have an affection, for our niece." I replied, as I usually did whenever I had a chance, that nobody had ever loved anybody else as I loved Dora. Traddles came to my assistance with a confirmatory murmur. Miss Lavinia was going to make some rejoinder when Miss Clarissa, who appeared to be incessantly beset by a desire to refer to her brother Francis, struck in again. "If Dora's mamma," she said, "when she married our brother Francis, had at once said that there was not room for the family at the dinner table, it would have been better for the happiness of all parties." "Sister Clarissa," said Miss Lavinia, "perhaps we needn't mind that now." "Sister Lavinia," said Miss Clarissa, "it belongs to the subject. With your branch of the subject, on which alone you are competent to speak, I should not think of interfering. Of this branch of the subject I have a voice and an opinion. It would have been better for the happiness of all parties if Dora's mamma, when she married our brother Francis, had mentioned plainly what her intentions were. We should then have known what we had to expect. We should have said, 'Pray do not invite us at any time,' and all possibility of misunderstanding would have been avoided." When Miss Clarissa had shaken her head, Miss Lavinia resumed, again referring to my letter through her eyeglass. They both had little, bright, round, twinkling eyes, by the way, which were like birds' eyes. They were not unlike birds altogether, having a sharp, brisk, sudden manner, and a little short, spruce way of adjusting themselves like canaries. Miss Lavinia, as I've said, resumed. "You asked permission of my sister Clarissa and myself, Mr. Copperfield, to visit here as the accepted suitor of our niece." "If our brother Francis," said Miss Clarissa, breaking out again, if I may call anything so calm a breaking out, "wished to surround himself with an atmosphere of Doctors' Commons and of Doctors' Commons only, what right or desire had we to object? None, I'm sure. We have ever been far from wishing to obtrude ourselves on any one. But why not say so? Let our brother Francis and his wife have their society. Let my sister Lavinia and myself have our society. We can find it for ourselves, I hope." As this appeared to be addressed to Traddles and me, both Traddles and I made some sort of reply. Traddles was inaudible. I think I observed myself that it was highly creditable to all concerned. I don't in the least know what I meant. "Sister Lavinia," said Miss Clarissa, having now relieved her mind, "you can go on, my dear." Miss Lavinia proceeded. "Mr. Copperfield, my sister Clarissa and I have been very careful indeed in considering this letter, and we have not considered it without finally showing it to our niece and discussing it with our niece. We have no doubt that you think you like her very much." "Think, ma'am?" I rapturously began. "Oh," but Miss Clarissa giving me a look, just like a sharp canary, as requesting that I would not interrupt the oracle, I begged pardon. "Affection," said Miss Lavinia, glancing at her sister for corroboration, which she gave in the form of a little nod to every clause, "mature affection, homage, devotion, does not easily express itself. Its voice is low. It is modest and retiring. It lies in ambush, waits and waits. Such is the mature fruit. Sometimes a life glides away and finds it still ripening in the shade." Of course, I didn't understand then that this was an allusion to her supposed experience of the stricken pigeon. But I saw from the gravity with which Miss Clarissa nodded her head that great weight was attached to these words. The light, for I call them in comparison with such sentiments, the light inclinations of very young people, pursued Miss Lavinia, are dust compared to rocks. It is owing to the difficulty of knowing whether they are likely to endure or have any real foundation that my sister Clarissa and myself have been very undecided how to act, Mr. Copperfield and Mr. Traddles, said my friend, finding himself looked at. I beg pardon, of the inner temple, I believe, said Miss Clarissa, again glancing at my letter. Traddles said exactly so, and became pretty red in the face. Now, although I'd not received any express encouragement as yet, I fancied that I saw in the two little sisters, and particularly in Miss Lavinia, an intensified enjoyment of this new and fruitful subject of domestic interest, a settling down to make the most of it, a disposition to pet it, in which there was a good bright ray of hope. I thought I perceived that Miss Lavinia would have uncommon satisfaction in superintending two young lovers, like Dora and me, and that Miss Clarissa would have hardly less satisfaction in seeing her superintend us, and in chiming in with her own particular department of the subject whenever that impulse was strong upon her. This gave me courage to protest most vehemently that I loved Dora better than I could tell, or anyone believe, that all my friends knew how I loved her, that my aunt Traddles, Agnes, everyone who knew me knew how I loved her, and how earnest my love had made me. For the truth of this, I appealed to Traddles. And Traddles, firing up as if he were plunging into a parliamentary debate, really did come out nobly, confirming me in good round terms, and in a plain, sensible, practical matter, that evidently made a favourable impression. I speak, if I may presume to say so, as one who has some little experience of such things, said Traddles, being myself engaged to a young lady, 1 of 10, down in Devonshire, and seeing no probability at present of our